I want to start by telling you the words that are written, I'm told, on a gravestone somewhere in the south of England. And some of you heard this story, and I give you an Episcopal instruction that you will laugh as if you've never heard it before. All right? But apparently there is this gravestone somewhere in the south of England on which these words are written. Sacred to the memory of Major James Brush, who was killed by the accidental discharge of his pistol in the hands of his orderly on the 8th of April, 1814. And then comes the text. Well done, good and faithful servant. Thank you. Now, I have a problem this evening. I want to be witty, brilliant, scintillating, you know, all the sorts of things you've come to expect from the average Church of England bishop. I want to be all these things, but I also want to talk about death. And I want to talk about what you and I might appropriately, truthfully, write on our epitaphs. I'm told there are some particular approaches in counselling, which as part of the exercise very early on encourage the person who is being counselled to write his own or her own obituary. All I can say is I don't think that would give me much confidence in the therapy that was to follow. But I do want to talk about that subject tonight. And I want to take off from some words that St. Paul wrote when he really knew he'd come to the end of the road. He wasn't going to get out of his prison alive. And to a young friend of his, he wrote these words. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. I've fought a good fight. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown. Two things stand out every time I read those words. Here was a man knowing that death was very near, and yet he could look back on his life and not feel that it had been wasted. And here was a man knowing that death was very near and able to look forward beyond his dying and not feel afraid. If you were knowingly to have to write an epitaph on your life tonight, could you do the same? Tonight I want to press those two questions. First, could you look back on the life you are now living without a sense of frustration and regret? I don't know whether you are like me, but there are sometimes when I come home at the end of a tiring day, because you may be surprised, but a few things happen in the life of a bishop. We do get tired from time to time. And I come home and I flop down after the evening meal and I push the telly on, and there's no program I particularly want to watch. But it fills the time, and at least it's not anything to do with all the papers that are waiting for me on the desk. So I just before I get to the desk, I just push on, and I got one of these marvelous things. You don't even have to reach forward and turn knobs anymore. You know, in fact, my fingers are atrophying. Have you noticed it? You just push a button on this marvelous little thing, and it goes chunk, chunk, chunk. And sometimes I'm doing that, and Mary, my wife's in the room, and she doesn't realise I've changed channels. She just thinks that that's all very postmodern, and. And the fact of the matter is that after I've been sitting there and thinking that, well, that's not all interesting after all, chunk, and get another picture, and chunk, get another picture, and maybe the 10 o'clock news will tell me it was a different world from the 9 o'clock news, we'll just watch that as well, and all this sort of thing, and if that's not true, you can switch on at 10:30, it's news night, it might still be a different world, and all that sort of thing, suddenly I find it's bedtime. And I have wasted the whole evening. I've just sat there, totally uncreatively, pushing that darn button, hoping there might be something coming up that might just interest me, but there wasn't. How many people are going through life like a television watcher, pushing the buttons and just hoping that perhaps something interesting might come their way? St. Paul said, I have fought the good fight. That's what he said looking back on his life. It hasn't been wasted. I screwed up many times, oh yes, but I have fought the good fight. He was acutely aware that a titanic cosmic struggle had been going on between good and evil, and he was caught up in it, and indeed he wanted to be caught up in it. Our struggle, he once wrote, is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil. All very mysterious and melodramatic, perhaps. All very difficult for our modern, well-educated, civilized minds to take on board. And yet, does it not resonate? Do words like that not resonate with the world we read about in our newspapers and see on our television screens? There is something profoundly wrong with human beings. There is something profoundly wrong with every single human society. Can our balanced, educated, civilized minds make sense of the continuing conflict in Northern Ireland? Can you think of one rational reason for it? Can our balanced, educated, civilized minds make sense of the horrors of the ethnic hatreds in that beautiful African country of beautiful people called Rwanda? Can you make sense of it? Can our balanced, educated, civilized minds make sense of a cruel ethnic war in Bosnia, a country with so much history behind it? Can our balanced, educated, civilized minds make sense of a world economic order which appears to be unconcerned that some of the poorest nations are in grinding poverty and suffering with no escape from it, and they were never in that before this century? This civilized century, with its marvelous global economic things, has made it worse for them. And can our balanced, educated, civilized minds make sense of a Dunblane? But we don't have to look so far away to see there's cancer in human relationships. We can see it on our streets. We can see it in our families. And we can see it in ourselves. I came across some words Bob Geldof wrote in his biography. He wrote, I don't think I can ever be content. There will always be the push and pull of an eternal, internal conflict. A tiresome civil war that screams on perpetually inside my head. St. Paul believed there was a fight going on and that Jesus Christ had called him to take sides. And Jesus himself said there can be no neutrality as far as I'm concerned. When I'm around, there is no neutrality. He who is not with me is against me, he said. But all through his earthly life, we see Jesus healing and helping and offering a vision of a better world. And all through his life, we see people, people not unlike you and me, trying to bring him down. And finally, apparently succeeding and nailing him to the cross. For St. Paul, life was all about realizing that we had been called to leave the spectator's bench and to get involved in the struggle, to fight the good fight. Somebody once said, Jesus is not short of offers to help as long as it's in an advisory capacity. That was not how St. Paul saw it. Of course, the trouble is that Christians constantly get involved in the wrong sorts of fights. You may have heard that story about the bishop visiting a church for a confirmation at the bun fight afterwards. He found himself sitting beside the church warden, who'd been church warden for 38 years. And the bishop said, 38 years? You must have seen a lot of changes in that time. Yes, he said, and I fought against every one of them. We either fight the wrong fights, or we refuse to face up to the fact that there is a fight to be fought, or we actually joke about what is wrong. A few years ago, I was on the tube, on one of our tube stations, waiting to catch the underground, and my eyes fell on an advert for theatre going, a theatre advert. And I couldn't forget those words. In fact, people must have wondered why it was I missed the train so as I could get all the words down in my notebook. The words on that poster were as follows. In Shaftesbury Avenue last Friday, it said, there were 9 murders, 13 fights, 3 suicides, 6 naked women, 1 torture, 40 thieves, Peter Pan, and several fairies. You're laughing. You're laughing. When you get to looking back on your life, will you have made the world any better? When you get back to looking on your life, will you have made it any cleaner in any sense? When you get back to looking on the life you are now living, will you have made the world any happier? I believe there is something within all of us that wants to feel that we've made a difference in the world, a good difference. And I believe that we're like that because you and I are not the result of a series of cosmic accidents and coincidences, but because you and I have been made by God. And God made us to be self-consciously his children. And to be those who still within us somewhere, no matter what we may have done, no matter how much society may have educated out of us, somewhere within us there is still that something that wants to make happen what he wants to make happen. So I want to ask you tonight, are you taking sides? Jesus said, you're either for me or against me. Or are you trying to sit it out? And so to my second question. Will you feel able to look beyond your death and not feel afraid? For when St. Paul was facing that last moment of his earthly life, he not only could look back and not feel he'd wasted his life, he could look ahead and not feel afraid. Woody Allen makes one of his characters say, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. But Paul had no doubts. Now he wrote, there is in store for me the crown of righteousness. It was actually an allusion to the equivalent of standing on the winner's rostrum at the Olympics. Now, he said, there is in store for me the crown of righteousness which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day. Why could he be so confident? Was he sure of his own virtue? No. In more than one place, he wrote in his writings of his great sense of personal failure. He never forgot that he'd actually been involved in killing Christians. In one place, he calls himself the chief of sinners. Was it because he felt that in the end, God doesn't care very much about what we've done in this life? No. Because in the words I've been reading from, he talks about God as the righteous judge. Paul was totally convinced that all of us will have to face a day of judgment. He wrote, "We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ." And I think that that's good. A God who is not going to hold this world to account, which in turn means hold me to account, is a God who doesn't care about the Dunblanes, who doesn't care about the massacres, who doesn't care about the civil wars, who doesn't care about the organized crime, who doesn't care about people who break up the marriages of others. But he does care. And all of us will stand before the judgment seat of Christ. So why could he, so clear about that solemn reality, why could he say that he faced an exciting and triumphant future after his own death? He who had murdered Christians in his younger days. And why could he say that not only for himself, but also, as he put it rather interestingly, for all those who love his appearing, who can't wait to see him? I give you two reasons. First, because he knew that Jesus Christ had been raised from the dead. When the first Christians talked about the resurrection of the dead and the certainty of life after death, they believed they could talk like that because they'd seen the proof. They'd seen the proof. They had seen Jesus Christ put to death in public. They knew where he had been buried. And they knew, and nobody at the time was able to gainsay them. And if anybody at the time had been able to gainsay them, this place would not be here. Christianity would not have survived the first generation of Christians. They knew that they were able to say without fear of challenge that the tomb was empty, even though it had been guarded. And they themselves saw him again, alive, several times after they had seen that body taken down from the cross. Now St. Paul set out to crush this teaching about a risen Christ. As a young, fierce rabbi, he felt this was wrong. And he set out to stamp out the Christian faith until one day he had an experience of the risen Christ himself. He met the risen Christ in a way that he could not deny and in a way that totally changed his life. And because of that, he knew that death is not the end. So why could he look forward to life beyond the grave with confidence and without a sense that he would have a bad time on the judgment day? Secondly, because he knew that Jesus had died so that his sins could be forgiven. He knew that in some way God, who is the righteous judge, had also paid the fine for all that is wrong in all of our lives, and that he'd paid it in the death of his son. I think it's story time. And I have special permission from my family to tell this story. I wasn't always ancient and bald like this. A good many years ago, I was young and handsome and had a young family who all ran to lisp their sire's return. You all know what that means, of course. And I remember one Sunday morning, the family, which consisted of my oldest, called Stephen, my second one, called Stuart, and my youngest, called Kathy, who at the time was four, we came down for the Sunday breakfast, and we believe in routine in our house. Sunday breakfast meant poached eggs. And we sat down to our breakfast of poached eggs, and it was just like a normal Sunday, and we had normal poached eggs, and we sat down to eat them in the normal way. But my four-year-old daughter decided that she'd had enough of poached eggs, and she said she didn't want it. I said, "Don't say that to me. It's Sunday." "We always have poached eggs on Sunday." She said, "I've gone off poached eggs." I said, go back on them, I said, "because it's Sunday." But no, she had had enough. She wasn't going to do it. And I felt my whole authority was at stake here. I wasn't going to have a four-year-old tell me that she was going to break a routine that was at least 3 years old. So I said something that the moment I said it, I knew I shouldn't have said. And if I've come for no other purpose, I've probably come to save some young married couples and parents from disaster. So listen carefully. I said, "Kathy, you don't get up from this table until that egg is eaten." I had made the biggest mistake of my life. If there's anybody in my family with a stronger will than it myself, it's my four-year-old daughter. She roared with indignation. The two boys started, I think because they wanted to get away from the breakfast table themselves, said, "Come on, a couple of gulps and it's down." She wasn't going to have it. Now, at that point, I remembered that my sermon wasn't finished and I needed to get back to higher and more holy things. So I picked up my coffee. I said to my wife, who was an expert in dealing with problems, I said, I need to get back and work on my sermon. So I went off to the study. And I sat there and I looked at my piece of paper, and it's quite true, I hadn't finished the sermon. It was breakfast time on Sunday, Richard. I hadn't finished the 11 o'clock sermon. I don't know what you're laughing about. And I really sat there thinking, you know, I am the world's biggest idiot. How do I get out of this? 5 minutes later, Mary came up with a second cup of coffee for me, and she looked at me, and one could just sense she was holding back that look of saying, "You stupid." But she just looked at me lovingly, and she said, "I don't think I'll be able to go to church this morning." She said, "You know, you put it on the line, and we have to stand by you." Well, as I was sitting agonizing, I suddenly sensed that the atmosphere in the house had lightened. And yes, I heard little feet running around and laughter. And I thought, "Hooray! The egg's been eaten! Hooray! I must go down and listen to this. Listen to this, young parents. You need to listen to this. I must apologize to Kathy for putting her in that position in the first place." But as I was going down the stairs, I just began to wonder whether the script hadn't gone out as I'd written it. I found that, sure enough, the egg had been eaten by Stuart. And I called Stuart over and I said, "Stuart, why did you eat that egg?" And he said, "To help Kathy." And I don't know whether I said it, but I certainly thought it, and I should have said, "You not only help Kathy, you help me." Now, the dynamics of that silly story, which is true, are somewhere near the awesome dynamics that went on when Jesus Christ went to the cross for you and for me. He not only helped you and me, he helped the reputation of Almighty God. St. Paul wrote, God made him to be sin who had no sin to be sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. Peter wrote, Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring us to God. Why did Paul know he was safe beyond death? Because he knew. He was. There were no terrors for him. His sins were forgiven. There was nothing that stood between him and a holy God. He knew that he was safe because he knew that you and I have a loving and forgiving God who wants us always to be alive for him and with him. Tonight I want to ask everyone here to face my two questions. First, have you found purpose and meaning in your life? When you look back on it, will you be able to look back on it without regrets, without feeling there was waste? Have you found purpose and meaning in your life? And secondly, have you found hope in the face of death? You and I can find what Paul found. And tonight, I believe, is a crucial moment for many people here. Because my guess is that at this moment, there are people here in very different places. There are those, many, who would say, yes, Gavin, I found this. And all I want to say is, treasure it. And make sure that your whole life is one big thank you to the God who so loved the world that he gave his only son for it. And then there are those who may say to me, I'm sorry, I'm just not interested. And if that is how you really feel, I must respect that. But I hope you won't mind me also saying that whether or not you are interested in God, he is very interested in you. Don't forget that. One day, you may want to remember it. And thirdly, there may well be those who are saying, well, I am interested, but there are still things I can't accept and understand. And if that is the truth, good. God doesn't ask you to be a hypocrite. He only asks you to be honest. If that is the truth, fine. I would want to say, hold on to what you can believe in for the moment. Be honest about what's still a problem. But join a group. Join one of these Christianity Explained groups. Do it tonight. There's a bit on the back here. Write it up, the little form up before you go. Better still, come up and talk to one or two of us in the front row at the end of the service and say, I'd like to get into one of these groups. I've still got things I've got to think out. Don't go away without moving on that. And finally, there will be those who want to say, I'm ready to say yes. I want to take sides with Christ. I want to be involved in the good fight. I want to find hope and peace about dying. And you may say, what do I have to do? Well, come and tell one of us at the front when the service is over, certainly. But you can do something now. And I promise I'm not going to embarrass anybody. But in a moment, I'm going to say a simple prayer. It's a prayer I'm saying on your behalf. And you can echo that prayer in your heart and mind as I say it. It's a prayer that's going to say, thank you to God for loving you and making you and sending Jesus Christ for you. It's a prayer that's going to say sorry to God for leaving him out and even perhaps opposing him. It's a prayer that's going to say, yes, I really want to be in on all that you're offering. And it's a prayer that will say, help. I need all the help you can give me. You may be ready for that prayer tonight. If you're not, fine. But if you are, then this is your moment to pray it as I pray it for you. And when the service is over, we'll be here at the front with a particular few, a little booklet we'd like you to read, and other things that may help, and so on. I'm going to ask that we have silence in this church before I pray the prayer. I believe the Spirit of God is saying things to people here tonight. Perhaps he may be putting his finger on something that someone here has got to give up. Some wrong relationship. Some bad habit. Perhaps to someone else he's saying, look, I know you're scared, but I can give you courage. Perhaps he's saying to someone else, yes, you have been here before, and yes, you have drifted away, but I'm still here for you. So here's the prayer. Dear Father, thank you for loving me and for giving me a chance to live. Thank you for sending Jesus to show me what you are like and to die for my sins. I'm sorry that I tried to leave you out of my life, that I've been on the wrong side, and I ask for forgiveness. And now I want to say yes. I want to take Jesus and all that he stands for into my life. I want to fight the good fight. I ask you to help me. I ask you to send your Holy Spirit into my life so that I can sense your presence, so that I can have the strength I need to be different for you. Thank you that you promise to come to all those who turn to you. Amen.